Well, good afternoon, everybody. This is Mark Roberts with Affinity Asset Management. Thank you for, once again, joining our teleconference. Again, kind of a large number of attendees on today's call with the biggest group in the Kansas City area and the second largest group coming out of the Minneapolis area. So thank you for everybody all over the United States tuning into this call here today. First, we apologize for a little bit of a raspy voice. My wife has me nonstop in my free time out in the farm planting vines and doing all kinds of outside work, and the spring allergies are just getting to me now by it's Wednesday here. So I'm struggling with that a little bit and drinking lots of hot tea with honey. So apologize if I sound a little raspy. So in addition to Affinity's 133 years of investment committee experience, we have with us today Michael Turner with American Century Investments, and he'll give us some perspectives from American Century's analysts and economists. Their point of view, he's going to share that with no emotions, no drama. He's going to give it to us the way that they see it. So today I'm going to give a little bit of spin on some things. I usually quote various analysts and economists on these teleconferences, and since we have Michael Turner on the phone here with us today, I'm going to not do that section, but I'm going to read you some reports of normal news that we all get from the news, and then I'll let Michael come in with the straight facts on some other things on how they see things. So let me first say that we'll apologize for today a little bit on a little bit of information being redundant. I try to have about 90% of my stuff that I share in these teleconferences to be new, and 10% is redundant of stuff I've already said before, and that's just primarily because we think it's an important topic to be discussed more than once, or it's because we have folks that can't always dial into these teleconferences every single week. So I'm just trying to repeat for those who didn't hear it before. All right, so I'm going to pose a question to you. I did this last week. I'm going to pose a question to you here this week, and you can come up with the answers during a Q&A session at the end. And here's my question to you guys, and there's no wrong answers to this, but I'm just going to kind of pose the question as to Affinity Asset Management's perspective. What's the two biggest things most financial advisors just do not do for their clients, period, whether it's before retirement, after retirement? What's the two most common things financial advisors don't touch, don't do, but you as a consumer, you as an investor, would expect your financial advisor to do? So what's the two most things not done by most financial advisors? That's my question. I'll repeat that again at the end, and then you guys can come up with the answers later. So some performance on the market. Last week, the market, the Dow, was down 1.93% for the week. Monday this week, it was up 1.15. Tuesday was just slightly negative, just barely below zero. Today, we've had a decent day, the market being up 2.6% today so far here. The market since February 19th's high is still negative 17.88, and our bonds haven't gotten their next round of dividends just yet, and when they do, they'll probably get close to breaking even. Bonds right now are negative 0.82, so really close to breaking even on that. A couple of tidbits for you. Now, I'm in the suburbs of Kansas City here in Overland Park, Kansas, and I think I either said something wrong in a previous teleconference or I just misunderstood the information. I thought where I was in Johnson County, Kansas, as a whole of Kansas City, as the suburbs of Kansas City, I thought we kind of fell into the jurisdiction of what Kansas City's mayor was putting into place on lockdown stuff. Coming to find out, that's not the case. That would basically be for Kansas City proper and not for necessarily Kansas City suburbs. So me being in Overland Park, Kansas, we technically fall under the jurisdiction of Kansas' rules, which the stay-at-home order will end on May 4th, but the Kansas City stay-at-home order was extended to May 15th. So for you all over the United States, if you're not in a major metropolitan city, like some of you up in the Minneapolis area, if you're not directly in Minneapolis, but you're in the suburbs of Minneapolis, you might want to double-check that. You might be more in the jurisdiction of Minnesota and not necessarily Minneapolis' mayor. Another tidbit, I get questions asked often about bonds because I think people understand stocks more than they understand bonds, and some of the more common questions we get on bonds are, Mark, are bonds 100% safe? And so I just want to make sure I'm kind of being clear on that. Bonds are not 100% safe. Bonds have risk. They have a very low degree of risk. And if I'm to quantify it and put it on a scale, let's say on a scale of 1 to 5, 5 is high risk, 1 is low risk, 0 is no risk. Bonds are going to be somewhere between a 0 and a 1, especially the kind of bonds that we have your money in right now, short-term, high-grade, corporate bonds, government bonds, very low risk. Yes, you can lose a little bit, less you can make a little bit, but the number one reason why people have bonds in their portfolio, in any kind of a diversified portfolio, the number one reason is because we don't want to have all of our money in stocks. We don't want all of that risk from the stock market. The number two reason that we have money in bonds is because we want a steady stream of dividends to come in regardless of the performance of the bond, we're always going to get paid that dividend. So technically right now, that's our number one reason to be in bonds, is because we want a nice steady stream of dividends to come in on our bond portfolio, which is greater than we can make in cash or money market, but without the risk and the volatility of the stock market. So that's why we're in bonds. So I just want to kind of clear that up a little bit. Here's a few facts. Coronavirus, cases globally, 3.1 million global cases with 218,000 global deaths. Here in the U.S., we've had a total of 1,035,000 cases. Now, last week when I did the teleconference, we were 819,000. That's an increase of 216,000. That's an increase of 26% from last week to this week. They say this curve is kind of flattening. It just means that 26% is kind of going down, but the number's still climbing. Don't get me wrong, it's still climbing. It's just, it's almost like a positive way that they phrase this flattening the curve, but the numbers are still climbing. Deaths here in the U.S., to be exact, 59,266 as of this morning. Last week when I reported it was 45,353. That's basically an increase, right, about 14,000 increase, which is a 31% increase in deaths. 31% increase from last week's death numbers. China's GDP, their gross domestic product, 50% is made up of consumer spending. So 58% of China's GDP is consumer spending. Here in the U.S., 70% of our GDP is consumer spending. So consumer spending is where we go out and make money. We go spend it, buy houses, cars, buy toys, buy gadgets, go out to eat all the time, buy food. We're spending money. So 70% of our economy is made up of consumer spending. So China's ahead of us in the coronavirus. They've had this longer and before us, of course. Their first quarter GDP dropped 6.8%. Our numbers came out this morning at 7:30 this morning here, Central Time, and we dropped 4.8%. Now, we were expected to drop 4%. So to put that into perspective, we expected the market, the GDP to drop 4, it dropped 4.8. Doesn't sound like a big difference, but that 0.8% difference is a 20% increase. It was 20% worse of a drop than what we expected. That's not good. All right, now this next segment, I call it my highlights. Highlights from news. Now this is where I usually kind of give you some good quotes from analysts and economists, which I'm going to save that section for Michael here in just a few minutes. But what I wanted to do is I wanted to share today with the kind of news that any of us can access from the TV or any of us can access from the internet. And keep in mind, TV news and internet news is emotions-based, it's drama-based, they're using more words that are colorful, they just want to make it a bigger deal, they want to make a bigger emphasis on things, because if you watch TV, they can sell their commercials, and they do that based on viewership watching their TV. So they want to keep you tuned in, they want to get you to tune in every day, every morning, every night on the news, they can sell more commercials that way. And the internet's the same way, it's kind of like pay-per-click, they can advertise on the internet, because of the amount of people who click through their website. So I want to just read you some stuff. And what I'm going to read you, there's a whole lot of facts and truth in what I'm going to read you. But just I want you to hear the words that I'm saying, because some of the words in these sentences are a little bit more dramatic than what we would hear from, let's say, our investment analysts and economists that we get from all of our investment professionals like Michael who we work with. Let me read you some of this. And I'm going to cite the source here on each one. Excuse me. First one is from CNN. U.S. could be in for a bad fall and a bad winter if it's unprepared for a second wave of coronavirus. A second round of coronavirus is inevitable, the nation's top infectious disease doctor says. But just how bad it is will depend on the progress the U.S. makes in the coming months. These sobering numbers come from some states moved to reopen despite warnings from the federal health officials. Being able to test for the virus, track cases, and isolate every infected American will be the key factors in ensuring that the second wave isn't as deadly. The U.S. continues to lag behind in testing. According to a new report by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, which I've never heard of them, the nation has performed 16.4 tests per every 1,000 Americans, according to this report. That's a pretty small number there. America's economy just had its worst quarter since 2008. The U.S. economy contracted for the first time in nearly 6 years between January and March. As the coronavirus crisis put the world in a chokehold, It was the first contraction in the U.S. economy since the first quarter of 2014 and the worst trough since the fourth quarter 2008, which was the height of that financial crisis. So I'm kind of trying to emphasize some of these dramatic words that they're putting into this. AP News. The U.S. economy shrank at a 4.8 annual rate last quarter, which again announced this morning at 7:30, as the coronavirus shut down much of the economy and began triggering a recession that will end the longest expansion on record. And that's what we had, basically from March 9th of 2009 through basically February 19th of this year was considered the longest expansion, biggest bull market, the longest bull market that we've ever had. Yet the drop in the January to March quarter will only be a precursor of a far grimmer report to come on the current April to June period. With business shutdowns and layoffs striking with devastating force, with much of the economy paralyzed, the Congressional Budget Office has estimated that the economic activity will plunge this quarter at a 40% annual rate. That would be, by a breathtaking margin, the bleakest quarter since such records were first compiled in 1947. It would be four times the size of the worst quarterly contraction on record since 1958. And I keep telling folks, you know, we expect this triple, quadruple shaped W, the market's going to go down, up, down, up, down, down. It's going to do this thing for a while. We don't have crystal balls to that. And I know that you guys know this. Nobody's got these crystal balls. Michael Turner at American Center does not have a crystal ball. But we believe that we're going to have this. We haven't even begun to see what is the rest of this W. So let me kind of point this out in points on the market. We've had three data points, and we're looking for point number four. First data point was on February 19th when the market hit all-time high on the Dow, it hit 29,500. March 23rd, market hit data point number two where it had dropped 11,000 points all the way down to 18,500 in 5 weeks. That's the second data point. The third data point is kind of where we're at today, where the market's at about 24,000, just under 25,000. So what's that third data point? So we don't know if that third data point is going to go a little higher or not, but the fourth data point is where it's going to go down again. How much down, we don't know. You read tons of these things, everybody's telling us, every analyst and economist is saying that we haven't even begun to see the worst part yet, and that's because of this entire shutdown that the economy had. And I love a quote that I said in a week or two ago that somebody had reported that I read about was, the economy turned off like a light switch, but it's going to turn back on with a dimmer switch. All right, let me read a little bit more here. Reuters, coronavirus savages U.S. economy in the first quarter. Bigger hit still to come. U.S. economy contracted in the first quarter at its sharpest pace since the Great Recession. The Great Recession was considered 2007, 8, and 9. As stringent measures to slow the spread of the novel coronavirus almost shut down the economy, ending the longest expansion in the nation's history. The drop in gross domestic product reported by Commerce Department on Wednesday morning, this morning, reflected a plunge in economic activity in the last 2 weeks of March, which saw millions of Americans seeking unemployment benefits. Here's some of the crazy stuff to read here. The rapid decline in GDP reinforced analysts' predictions that the economy was already in a deep recession and left economists bracing for a record slump in the output in the second quarter. If the economy fell this hard in the first quarter, with less than 1 month of a pandemic lockdown for most states, don't even ask how far it will crater in the second quarter, because it's going to be a complete disaster, said Chris Rupke, chief economist at MUFG in New York. I don't even know what MUFG is in New York, but he's a chief economist there. All right, so let's get off some emotions and drama. That's some of the articles I just want to read to you that we all seem to have access to. And some of these articles want to paint a negative picture, paint a positive picture. They want to trigger emotions because triggering emotions gets you to stay tuned in to them. So let's talk about some opportunities. Again, I'm trying to be a little bit short in my conversation here today, allowing plenty of time for Michael as well, and then plenty of time for Q&A at the end. Opportunities. For you guys that do your own tax returns, our broker-dealer client one securities that has now software that can integrate with your TurboTax. If you have questions, you just need to contact client one securities directly, and they can help answer any questions you have on downloading and getting stuff integrated for you. Roth conversions, you hear me beating the drum on that one every single week, every email, every teleconference. Roth conversions are a great time to do that right now with the market being down. Get more money into Roth IRAs, so when the market comes back up, you'll have more horsepower in the Roth IRA to grow for you tax-free versus growing tax-deferred in an IRA. 10% free transfers, taking money out of your annuities, specifically more like your indexed annuities that you have in IRA indexed annuities. You can take 10% out as long as it goes from an IRA indexed annuity over to your IRA brokerage. There's no taxes as long as it's within that 10% window that most annuities have. There's no penalties. There's no cost. There's no cost to go into brokerage. So we're just telling folks, if you want to get more money out of the annuities over into brokerage so you have more money in brokerage ready to go, so ready when we're looking for that fourth data point, we can buy into the market, you have more money to work for you when we do that. Safety discussion. Again, I want to remind you that bonds are not safe. Bonds are super low in risk, but they're not safe. And if you want to have a more detailed discussion on how you can have part of your portfolio to have some complete safety in it, that you can point your finger and say, you know, that chunk of my money will never lose. No matter what the stock market does, this piece will never go down. If you'd like to have that conversation and you don't already have something like an index annuity in your portfolio, give our office a call, ask to get scheduled with one of our advisors, and they can spend some time on the phone teaching you how to incorporate safety in your portfolio. Happy to do that for you. Another opportunity, trading, cycle trading. Again, that's just our terminology. That's not industry jargon. That's just us trying to find verbiage that makes sense to folks as you hear us talk about it. We can kind of say the same thing over and over, and you say it, we say it, we know what both parties are talking about. So cycle trading, you know, I talked about the three data points that we have looking for the fourth data point, and everybody right now is in bonds. And so the fourth data point, when that happens, we're going to take money out of the bonds and take 50% of the bonds and go into stocks. So at the highest risk level, when we do that, you'll be 50-50 stock and bond. So we're not looking at throwing anybody in the deep end. We're not looking for higher risk. We're just looking to get in and capitalize from the fourth data point to the fifth data point. We haven't gotten to number four yet. And we're hoping number four is going to come probably sooner or later. We expect it to come. But we just don't know exactly when that's going to be. I want to bring this up because many of us here in the office, on our investment committee, as well as the advisors here in the office, have had conversations with clients on this. And based on communication with you guys, and based on conversations we've had amongst ourselves, I have been saying in previous emails and in previous teleconferences that when we get to that fourth data point, we're going to take 50% and go into stocks. And again, this is on our fee-based brokerage accounts. When we do that, it's only going to be for IRAs and Roth IRAs. It's coming to our understanding, and we're agreeing to this, that the understanding is that clients are expecting us to treat all of their accounts that way, all of their fee-based accounts, whether it's an IRA, it's a Roth IRA, or a non-IRA. A non-IRA is what we call a non-qualified account. So we plan to do that with all accounts. So whatever I said before, just on IRAs and Roths, we're going to tweak that just because we've heard from you, we're listening to you, we want to treat all accounts that way. And the reason why we were hesitant on using non-qualified accounts before is just to try to minimize tax impact on those non-qualified accounts by dual buying, dual selling, dual buy, dual selling, and that triggers short-term capital gains. And short-term capital gains is a little bit of a higher tax to pay than long-term capital gains. So we're just trying to minimize tax. But at the end of the day, we've had enough conversations with clients. We don't have a lot of rule of thumbs, but the one rule of thumb that we do believe in is never let the tax tail wag the dog, meaning we should focus on performance. We should focus on risk. And performance is far more important than taxes. Making money and owing a little tax on it is better than making less money and paying less taxes. You come out ahead with more money, with more taxes. So that's where we're going to go. So we just want to let you know that we're going to do that. If in any reason that you don't want us to do that with your account, you just have to call us and let us know. We're happy to put a restriction on your account. When we take care of everybody else's accounts, we'll just, you know, exclude that one account for you and just make sure that we don't. But for now, all accounts are on the table that are all fee-based accounts. It's just that we have a $25,000 minimum because of trading minimums, mutual fund minimums, ETF minimums. For proper diversification, the account needs to be at least $25,000 or larger to be able to do that, but we're going to do it for all fee-based accounts that are $25,000 or larger, IRAs, Roth IRAs, non-IRAs. So we always say, guys, it's your money. It's always going to be your call. But our job is to take the emotions out of this. Okay? Make decisions for you, make decisions for us that are business decisions, black and white decisions. Look at the black and white, but know there's a lot of gray in things. And our job is to help you to decipher those gray areas and try to make the best sense of the information, the data that we have, so so the gray area can try to become a little bit more black and white when making decisions. But at the end of the day, it's your money. If you ever want to get back in the market sooner, you want to stay out of the market longer, you just got to let us know, because as a fiduciary, and we have discretion over your accounts, we plan to treat all clients equally unless you tell us otherwise to not treat you equally. You want a specific set of rules for you. So again, you just got to call us. A couple more opportunities, a couple of neat things. We're going to be starting in 2 weeks. I believe that's May the 13th. We're going to start doing this, I believe it's on Wednesday mornings at 8 o'clock. We're going to start having 30-minute webinar chat sessions. And this is going to be co-hosted between us at Affinity Asset Management, Stockton and Stern Law Firm, and First Option Bank, which is a nice, small, family-owned, community-style bank here in Kansas City. It's got 9 different bank branches. They're wonderful people over there. And we're going to have what's called a community cafe, where 2 of the 3 of us in that 3-panel group are just going to chat for 30 minutes. We're going to do this on Zoom.com so anybody can log in and see it. We're also going to stream it off of our phones on Facebook Live, so you can also watch it that way. And we're going to talk about topics. We're going to talk about some situations that we had with clients that, based on the situation, kind of what we've done. Kind of not necessarily want to call it case studies, but we want to just make it short 30 minutes of relevant stuff that is today's information, today's benefit, that 80% of the people on this phone call could benefit from that. Now, of course, not everybody can benefit from everything, but the goal is to find relevant material that we'll talk about every week, just for 30 minutes. I'll talk, another person will talk, I'll ask them questions, I'll ask new questions. You just get to see us having a live interaction. We're going to try to do that for a while and try to integrate how we can get audience who's out there on Zoom.com as well as on Facebook. Maybe that can ask questions and can send us messages and questions. We'll get to that kind of like the next step, but just want to introduce that concept. And we're going to call that Community Cafe. It's our way to talk about important topics to our communities without trying to sell anything, without pitching products, and just talk about important things. Next is we've kind of moved forward on doing webinars that we have signed up, I believe, for the next 4 weeks on Tuesday afternoons at noon. So for the next like 3 or 4 Tuesdays at noon, I'm going to be hosting a webinar strictly on estate planning between myself and Attorney Glenn Stockton with Stockton and Stern. About an hour long, we're going to talk about the pros and cons of not having an estate plan, talk about the pros and cons of using a will-based estate plan, and we'll talk about the pros and cons of having a trust-based estate plan. In addition, we're going to talk about the additional documents that you need to have, like powers of attorney for health care, powers of attorney for financial care, what is a living will, and how is a living will different from a regular will. We'll have that conversation. We've done this now twice, and we've had tremendous feedback from folks just giving us such great positive information back, how easy it is to understand and how we talk in layman's terms. If you want to sign up for one of those, you just need to email my office. You can call the office and talk to Kelly or Stacy, but if you want to email, you can email Kelly or Stacy. Kelly's email address is kellie@affinityasset.com. Stacy is stacy@affinityasset.com. Email them that you'd like to join. We got some weird things going on with the technology that we almost have to have like a week's notice. If you can give us notice by the end of the day that you want to participate in next week's one, great. But if you don't make up your mind today and you decide sometime in the next couple days, most likely you're not going to be able to get on next Tuesday's webinar, but you can get on the following Tuesday's webinar, and we can coordinate that with you through email or phone call if you want to get on that. Okay, move on to my last section before I introduce Michael. Reminders, my reminder section. I know I bring this up, guys. I say it a lot, and I apologize. I'm really not trying to be pushy. You know my personality. It's not my style. But referrals. We're just passionate about that right now. I don't ask for referrals in the past. It's just that I love getting referrals, and we thank you for the referrals. But we really just don't ask for referrals in the past, and we're going out of our way to do that. And something I've been saying of late is that we can all do our part and be socially distant and try to stay 6 feet apart, stay home, work from home, and do these sort of things. And some of us can take it a step farther and go out in the community and put a mask on, put gloves on, and go pass out things and hand out things and help others in need. We can do these things. But not everybody can do what we do. And 99.9% of the financial advisors out there can't do what we do. We just have a collective amount of knowledge, brain trust here in this office, an amazing talent of people, amazing amount of experience, and amazing amount of technology to help others do things for their money, get them out of the markets, reposition them ready for the different data points to get in or get out, and then start doing the other things that they should be doing with their money, separate from diversification, separate from money management, the other things that they should be doing for their overall retirement planning stuff that their advisor's not doing. So I just ask you, please go out of your way to tell others about us. Effective last Wednesday, I made this announcement last Wednesday. With compliance approval, effective last Wednesday, which would be, what, April 22nd, we're going to inspire you guys to give us referrals by offering Amazon gift cards to folks that give us referrals. These people turn into clients. The thing is, that's like an enticement. We can't do that. So there has to be a catch. And the catch is, we can't give a gift card to everybody. We have to do a drawing. We have to do a random drawing. But with compliance approval, we can do a very high odds random drawing. So basically, for every 10 people that get referred to us and they do business with us and we help them out, we're going to do a random drawing for 9 people. 9 out of 10 people is going to get an Amazon gift card. We thought Amazon because you can shop from home and be safe. Get your products from Amazon. And it's our way of saying thank you for helping others. Thank you for helping our community. Thank you for helping Affinity Asset Management. So we want to reward you by saying thank you with an Amazon gift card. So 9 out of 10 people will be winning gift cards. So please tell people about us. Give us their name and number. We'll call them. Give them our name or number. They can call us. Whatever's best for you, please make that happen. Next reminder, if you got questions, you have questions and you need advice, you need opinions, please call us and talk to us. If you know what you want to do, you want to take some money out of an annuity and move it to your brokerage. You want to do a Roth conversion, move the money from IRAs to Roth. You know what you want to do, shoot us an email. You already have our email addresses. You know a lot of our email addresses. Send it to somebody in here. We'll get it passed around to the right person. We'll always call back and confirm it. But if you got a service request, you know what you want to do, we just say after these emails and these teleconferences, we get a high demand of activity of people wanting things. And if a whole bunch of people call us all at once, it's just we're going to get a lot of people going into voicemails, and we really don't want to do that. We'd rather just shoot us a quick email. That way we can call you back right away, and that way we can actually talk to you the first time and not play phone tag. So call us if you need advice or opinions, and email us any service requests. All right, so before I introduce Michael here in just a second, I'm going to remind you of what my question was at the beginning. The question was, from a Affinity Asset Management's perspective, there's a lot of things that we do, a lot of things financial advisors do, but I'm asking you, what do you think is our opinion at Affinity? What's the top two things most financial advisors just don't do for people? Should, but don't do it. It's things that need to be done before retirement, after retirement, it just should be done. So I'm curious what your two, there's lots of things. There's no wrong answer. And I'm going to shout them out when I hear them, but what are your top two things? All right, so having said that, let me bring on the call here with us. I got Michael Turner. Now, Michael's actually become a pretty good friend of ours, not just a strategic partner with great information and great knowledge behind him at American Century. He's actually become a good friend of ours. Super picky. As you know, we have access to a lot of Michael Turners in the investment world out there to give us information, but not a lot of them have the ability to, let's say, speak in layman's terms to our clients. They're used to speaking to a bunch of financial advisors, which is a different type of communication. Michael's great because he's great at speaking to us in a way that we understand, but he's also great to talk to our clients in a way that they understand. Michael, his title is Vice President, Advisor Consultant. He's been with American Century for 13 years, and he's been our strategic partner directly with American Century for the last 4 years, and it's been a great 4 years and very beneficial to us. So I'm going to turn it over to Michael. Michael's got a couple talking points he's going to bring up today from American Century's perspective. And taking out drama, taking out emotions, he's going to tell us how they see things. And then when he gets done, we're going to open it up to Q&A. So, Michael, come on board and join us for a minute.
Hey, thank you so much, Mark. If I do some quick math, being that this is my 13th going into 14th year at American Century, that means I'm 35 years old, so technically a millennial, one of the oldest millennials by definition, by about 18 months. Therefore, I should know how to operate technology effectively. I just want to do a quick temperature check. Did I successfully unmute myself?
Yes, we can hear you fine.
Perfect, perfect. Well, hey, first and foremost, I want to thank everyone on the teleconference today that is sharing their time with us. When I say we, I mean Affinity Asset Management and American Century. We operate in this financial services, asset management ecosystem, but I want to be quick to realize that and acknowledge that time is truly your most valuable asset, and it certainly means a lot to both parties today that you've allocated some of your time today to become better educated. And then secondly, in my industry experience and in my role, I get the opportunity to work with a lot of advisor groups. There's actually, Mark and I were talking, there's 7,300 advisors that I technically cover. By no means do I work with all of those advisors as close as I do with Affinity Asset Management. But what the best advisory groups do, in my experience, is they provide educational platforms like this teleconference to deliver content to their clients. And what I've noticed essentially is these advisory groups who create this platform have more intelligent clients who in turn make better decisions. And essentially that translates into better long-term outcomes. This isn't easy. This takes time, energy, effort, coordination, aggregation of information, as Mark kind of ran us through on the first 25 minutes of this call. But a big thank you for organizing this call, everyone from the Affinity team, and thank you for including me. So
absolutely.
What Mark and the team really had asked me to – thanks, Mark. What you had asked me to talk about was what has – actually transpired? How should we digest this? I mean, it's been almost biblical with all the downs and ups and downs, but then really focus in on where do we think we're going. And in my comments today, I'm going to take us on a trip down memory lane just for context, but then the lion's share of my comments are going to be about what are the intermediate term expectations for the bond market, for the stock market, as there's been more scrutiny on share buybacks and dividend policies. And then lastly, and most importantly, I want to end on, you know, why should we remain optimistic and optimistic for the intermediate term? As Mark and team have mentioned, there is a lot of uncertainty going on right now. So I do want to congratulate everyone on this call. We were all a part of history in the sense that in January, we crossed 130 months of an economic expansion. That is literally the longest expansion in U.S. history. And to give you some context behind, like, how long that was, the average economic expansion or bull market lasts 48 months. Conversely, the average recession lasts 15. So we were almost 3x longer in this expansionary period than in normal times. And you got to ask why. Why did that happen? It was driven on the backs of a really, really strong consumer. And the consumer was strong in a number of ways. Unemployment was at a 50-year low. The consumer was increasing their saving rates. They were paying down debts. Consumer confidence was high. And then simultaneously, we collectively, as global investors, were hit with not one, but two black swan events. COVID-19 has stolen the show. They've stolen every headline out there. We all know what's going on. This is a health crisis like we have not seen in literally 100 years. And it started as a supply shock. And what that means is it started in China and it disrupted global supply chains. But it morphed into this different kind of animal. And on the back end, it created a demand shock with shelter-in-place orders, not just in the United States, but globally. It's essentially hamstrung the consumer. We're going to talk a little bit more about why that is so important to understand throughout my prepared comments today. The second black swan event that's slightly less talked about is the collapse of OPEC and oil. And to take you on a trip down memory lane, in 2016, the Saudis and the Russians, two of the biggest energy producers, came together. And they essentially formed an alliance to maintain production and prices in the oil market. In December of last year, the oil price started to slide a little bit. And so essentially what happens is the Saudis called the Russians and they said, hey, I think we need to do a supply cut. So imagine it like this. If they agreed on a supply cut, and demand stayed the same, yet there was just less oil out there in the market, the price of oil should stabilize or potentially increase. So that was the goal of the initial conversation. The Russians poo-pooed the idea, specifically Putin. And the reason Putin didn't want to cut supply is because the American shale producers were nibbling at his heels. He was worried the American shale producers would take market share. And what essentially happened is the Saudis not only cut production, but they also cut the price of oil. What they underestimated was Russia's ability to withstand these price cuts. And then on the back end, they had complete demand destruction from COVID. And I, a lot of times when I'm giving these updates and sharing American Century's information, I often get asked, is this like any other downturn or correction or economic event that, you guys have seen in the past? And the short answer is no. The anecdotal evidence that I would share with you, just to kind of bring that to light, many of you probably noticed that oil actually went negative last week. Oil, has the asset, the commodity, has never gone negative before. And I wanted to talk through the inner workings just to help you understand as to why oil went negative. So essentially, when an investor buys oil, they're not actually buying the actual asset or the black liquid. What they're buying are futures contracts. And the way to think of futures contracts are essentially an agreement between a buyer and a seller to sell or buy a specific asset, in this case oil, at a future agreed upon date at a future agreed upon price. So what happened was when the Saudis cut production and cut prices, oil was cheap. And big governments across the globe filled up their oil reserves. And essentially, there was nowhere to put this oil. So when these futures contracts came due, and they actually had to deliver the physical asset, these owners of these ETFs, individual investors, couldn't park oil in their front yard. So they actually had to pay people to take oil away from them, the commodity. And that's why it went negative. That's how wild this market has been and how this uncertainty will potentially perpetuate in the future. Mark mentioned GDP a couple of times. If you guys have heard me present in person, I often take it upon myself to make sense of this alphabet soup that a lot of people in the asset management business use. GDP stands for gross domestic product, and it's essentially the way we measure the output of that economy, in this case, the United States. Our GDP numbers came out this morning. For the first quarter, they were negative 4.8%. GDP is a pretty simple arithmetic equation. It's C, which stands for consumer, plus G, which stands for government spending, plus I, which stands for business investment, plus X, which stands for exports. If you add up those four variables, you will figure out whatever region's economic output or GDP. Mark had mentioned the consumer in the U.S. accounts for 70% of our GDP. So with the consumer stuck at home and not able to buy goods and services like they had in years past, the largest component of our GDP shrank dramatically. So to counteract that, our government stepped in. And this is what I wanted to be clear on what I shared, the government actions in the sense to how they're trying to help right this ship. Number one, what the government did, the Fed specifically, they took interest rates to zero, and the hope there is to promote economic activity. Number two, they got through a massive fiscal package called the CARES Act, and it's supposed to help those who are most affected by the closure of our economy, that is businesses and individuals alike. Goldman Sachs came out and they said that 95% of the consumers are affected by COVID. The last thing they did, the central bank did to really support our markets was this notion called QE Infinity. It stands for quantitative easing, and they latched on infinity this time because there's no limits to how much the central bank is going to support the markets. And I wanted to provide you some context as to why they did the third leg of this stool and how that's going to translate into fixed income performance in the intermediate term. So if you were to go to market in normal times and try to buy a U.S. Treasury bond, it's a security. So you would pay a bid-ask spread. In normal times, that bid-ask spread is 1/32nd of 1%. That's very tight. And what that indicates is there's a lot of liquidity or trading activity in treasuries. What happened after these dual black swans is that bid-ask spread in the most liquid asset class in the world went to a full point. So there was 32 times less liquidity in the most liquid market in the world than there are in normal times. That's why the Fed came in and they said, hey, we are here to support the capital markets. We will buy commercial paper. We will support money market funds. We are going to buy investment-grade bonds, high-yield bonds, and asset-backed securities. Policy response worked and lagged. So we have seen a bit of normalcy return to the bond market. That's ever apparent in some of the performance information that Mark and team have shared with you all. But over the coming weeks, months, and quarters, you should see more normalcy. Now, the intermediate term impact of this, all this money going into bonds, is that interest rates will likely stay low in perpetuity. And so when we're thinking about the fixed income side of a portfolio, we wholeheartedly agree with the structure that the Affinity team has taken, and that is own bonds to behave like bonds, which means preservation of capital, responsible income, and a ballast or a diversifier against equities or stocks. So we're favoring government bonds and investment-grade corporate bonds. In the sense of diversification, what we want to see or what we like to see is when your stocks go up, maybe your bonds go down a little bit, but when your stocks go down a lot, your bonds step in and they maintain that preservation of capital for you. The second thing that I wanted to focus on is this concept of, or scrutiny, I should say, on share buybacks and dividend policies. There's been a lot of consternation about this topic. Last time I presented to this group last year, there was actually a question about share buybacks. And amidst COVID, all these large and small companies are seeking bailout funds that some investors are questioning the why behind, that if they didn't push capital back to investors, they may be in better financial position to weather this storm. In lieu of that, public companies are starting to rethink their buyback policies and dividend policies from a risk management perspective and to essentially navigate these political and financial pressures. So for context, for those of you on the phone, over the last 3 years, companies in the S&P 500 index have spent $2 trillion buying back their own shares, and many others have implemented dividend policies. Now, I want to flip the script, and I'd like to role play a little bit. Imagine that you're the CEO of some publicly traded company. You have $100 million in cash to invest, and your job is to invest it in as profitable as manner as possible to maximize the value of your company. So in reality, as CEO, you have three options. Number one, with that cash, you can invest in a new factory and hire workers. Number two, or B, you could invest in a, quote, startup company that complements your core business. That would essentially mean you opening up a new line of business where you have very little expertise and exposure currently in the hopes for higher returns. Option C is you distribute cash to shareholders vis-a-vis buybacks or dividends. Your shareholders would take that money, and then they in turn would invest it more aggressively. So focusing first on the share buyback example, how does this work? Company has cash. Well, let me take a step back. Going back to option C or three, your company looks more attractive to shareholders or investors when you have a commitment to push capital back to them. So many of these companies, namely the airlines, have really engaged in share buybacks and heavy dividend policies over the last couple of years. These are the same companies that are trying to get bailout money right now. So to be clear about share buyback, I want to kind of explain how this works and why companies have been doing it outside of the fact that it delights investors. Number one, when they're doing this share buyback notion, they're taking cash, they're buying stock in their own company, and they're retiring those shares. So the shares are going away. There's less publicly available shares of ABC Company. Now, investors have already been hooked on the capital flow back to them, and they want exposure to ABC Company, but there are less shares out there, so demand is staying the same. There's less shares. The price of the stock typically gets a boost. From a dividend policy perspective, this has been a little bit more like a straitjacket for companies, because once you issue a dividend, the end investor hates to see that go away. They almost see it as a guarantee of sorts. Investors loathe dividend cuts, and management loathe cutting dividends. This year, 105 companies have already cut their dividend. That is more than the aggregate number of companies over the last decade. So in the equity markets, we have seen a really good tailwind due to share buybacks and dividend policies. The outcome of COVID, essentially, we think companies are going to rethink how they're managing their own balance sheets, which could change the trajectory or create more uncertainty in the short term. This will absolutely all be worked out in the long term, but that is by far and away one of the hottest debated topics right now, especially on the heels of the CARES Act. The very last thing I wanted to talk about was reasons to be optimistic. We acknowledge that we're going to get incredibly bad Q2 numbers. Now, the market needs to essentially acknowledge and continue to digest this new data that typically is essentially stale if it's not within the last 6 hours. And we, like Affinity, agree that there will be more volatility in the equity markets, and what the market is going to reward is not speed and haste, i.e. performance chasing, trying to jump back into equities to catch the upside, but rather patience and a plan. So a more systematic approach. Mark referenced cycle trading. That is a very good example of a systematic approach to trading the market we're in now, where you're removing emotion from it. But reasons to be optimistic. Number one, the Fed support. This QE Infinity program, what the Fed is doing is providing a backstop for that left tail event. It will take months or quarters for this to work its way through the system, but that is part of the silver lining that we're in right now. Number two, drug companies across the world are collectively working endless hours to find a therapy, a drug, or a vaccine to help prevent or heal COVID-19. And the economic reward at the end of this rainbow will be the largest economic reward that any drug company will ever receive. And so we think, talking to some of the scientific companies that we meet with, that they will find something legitimate over the next 12 to 18 months. That's not necessarily in the short term. I know there's been a lot of excitement around remdesivir from Gilead. We need to see more activity like this, but everyone is working collectively together, marching in the same direction. The other thing that we're going to see, too, is an increased level of testing. We're just, at this point, not testing enough and don't have enough data to fully understand the virus. The last reason why we're optimistic is that we know that innovation is what drives our economy, and then it perpetuates out around the globe. And what COVID-19 has essentially made us do is we've had 10 years worth of innovation unfold in 6 weeks. Companies have moved platforms to the cloud. People are communicating over virtual mediums. We're reducing cost out of the system that would have taken 5 years, 10 years to get out of the system. We did it all in 6 weeks. And so as we flatten this curve, we get back to some form of normalcy, whenever that might be, we would expect, you know, strong expected returns in the intermediate term. It's just a matter of when at this point. With that, I want to just take a moment and recap what we talked about. Number one, first and foremost, it's just how unique this Affinity Asset Management Group is and their eagerness and willingness to provide these educational platforms. There are literally less than 50 groups out of the 7,000 I cover that are this forward-thinking and in tune with their own client base. If you're going to brag about anything about your advisor, brag about that. I mean, they are truly bringing this educational platform to you. The second thing we talked about is what happened, and it was two black swans at once. It was COVID, then it was oil, and then on the back end, it was demand destruction. And the intermediate term impacts of these things are, or the short term impacts are uncertainty. The intermediate term impacts, we're starting to understand those better, and there are ways to trade around that. Before I conclude, I do want to turn it back to Mark and just see if there are questions. I know that a lot of the information I shared was anecdotal, but happy to go into any more detail as need be.
Well, Michael, as usual, that was awesome. Great input and great way to explain it. Thank you so very much. So the audience listening in here, if you have a question for myself or Michael, you need to hit *7 on your phone, and it will unmute you to the whole conference. Just realize a couple of quick things. We're going to be able to hear your background noise, so just be sensitive of that. And number two, you got a question, please feel free to ask that question. Don't give us like a 3, 4, 5 minute story to build up to the question. We want to be sensitive to other people's time available. So if you have a question, *7 to unmute yourself. My question was to the audience, what do you think from Affinity Asset Management's perspective, what's the top two things most financial advisory firms don't do for their clients? So I'd love to hear your opinions on that. And Michael, while people start to *7 themselves to unmute themselves, I actually took quite a few good notes. I got to say it was the funny thing that you said. You talked about how Putin poo-pooed the idea. Now that you said without messing up your speech. Now that I think that would have messed me up if I would have said Putin poo-pooed the idea. So I love that. All right, so audience, anybody wants to shout out, just go first. No raising hands. We can't see you, so shout out and just let us know you have a question for Mark or for Michael.
Hey, Michael, it's Tom Strandell over here, a senior partner in the other office. A common question that I get from a lot of my clients is just asking about the impact of companies that had good credit ratings and now are being downgraded. How's that going to affect the future of those companies and really what their financials look like relative to the market?
Yeah, great question. Thank you, Tom, and hello. So you're right. There was a tremendous amount of companies at this what we call BBB rated debt level, and that is investment grade by a hair. As they become downgraded, their cost of capital is going to increase. So that when they go to the bond market and they want to raise money for a new factory or project or to do R&D, the yield that investors are going to charge on those bonds is going to be more than it was in the past. And essentially what that's going to translate into is a drag on their stock performance. Now, when you're thinking about just the fixed income market and not the stock side of the house or the stock side of the ledger, we do think that there are going to be defaults and downgrades over the summer months as a lot of not just small businesses but public businesses, they can float their payroll and their operations for a month, a quarter, half a year, but it's hard to float all those expenditures for 12 to 18 months, and that is why we are really encouraging investors for the bond side of their portfolio to move up in credit quality, invest in higher quality paper, whether it's U.S. government bonds or much higher rated corporate bonds.
Excellent. Thank you.
Okay.
Any other questions? Michael, we got a group of shy listeners today, or we both just did an excellent job of explaining what we need to explain here. I'll just get another minute or two here and see if anybody else wants to hop on and ask a question. Anybody have answers to the questions? What do you think is the top two things we believe that most financial advisors don't talk about? I'll give a minute on that. Michael, are you working out of your home? I'm assuming you are not working out of American Century right now. Is that right?
Yes, yeah, so we've taken a very conservative approach. We've been a work-at-home mandate for the last 7 weeks, and we will not go back to the office until we can ensure safety of all of our clients who visit us and employees. We have about 1,400 employees. 1,400 out of 1,400 were working remotely or virtually over the last 8 weeks. So we've really tried to embrace sort of this innovative period and not miss a step.
Well, while we are talking here, and I can't really read and listen to you, I can't read and talk at the same time. I just saw something that popped up on my screen that was sent around throughout the office. And, again, not having read it all, there's just a glimpse of Kansas City Mayor just came out and announced a new 10-10-10 policy to go into effect. And I think it's part of the phase-out of the shutdown stay-at-home order. And there's so everybody needs, you know, everybody in the Kansas City area probably should be watching their news tonight to see exactly what that means. Something like 10% of a building can be occupied at any one time, or 10 people in allowed at any one time, 10 minutes per person in time. I don't know what that means. So I think they'll probably explain it more in the news tonight. All right, so I'll just say that from Affinity Asset Management's perspective, when we come across folks that you guys refer to us, and in times like this, people get referred to us because of money management, and they're working with a financial advisor that just doesn't seem to do much for them. The money's just being left alone, and it's like the advisor's paralyzed, therefore the account's paralyzed, and money just goes up and down. As the market goes up and down, there's not a lot of management. It's just investment sold. So the two things we find that are the top two things financial advisors don't do or don't talk about with their clients, number one is tax-saving strategies, doing things like Roth conversions and other things that can help minimize tax for the rest of someone's life, as well as pass on a bigger inheritance to their kids, because kids will inherit more assets because kids will have to pay less taxes. So tax-saving strategies is probably number one. Number two is creating an income stream that minimizes the damage to a portfolio. So in other words, when you take money out of your accounts because of just a one-time withdrawal, like to buy a car or a home improvement project or just to live on every month in retirement time, when you take money out of your accounts, you hurt the accounts because you're taking a withdrawal. There are ways to do that and cause less harm. And what most financial advisors do is they just set up a client's portfolio that it's a certain dollar amount, let's say $2,000 every month on the 15th of every month. Whether that day, the 15th, is an up or down day, it's going to trigger a $2,000 sale on the 15th of every month. So that's not the right way to do it. That's a lazy way to do it. So I'd say our number two way, the number two things that financial advisors don't do is tax saving strategies and how to create proper income for people and to take one-off withdrawals or consistent monthly withdrawals. That's our top two answers there. Everybody, thank you so much for your time here today and being on today's teleconference. We're right at 1 hour. Michael, as usual, thank you so much for your input. Great job of explaining this. Thank you to you and all your folks at American Century for your work you do for us behind the scenes that our clients don't see. They don't really know. So it's nice for us to be able to showcase you, and great that you're also local on top of that in the Kansas City area. Thank you so much for that. Michael, any last parting words?
My only concluding thought is, you know, just on behalf of obviously American Century, and I know I'm speaking for Mark and the team at Affinity, that, you know, we hope you guys are safe and taking care of yourselves and your families and adjusting to this new work-life paradigm. It takes time to kind of find the operating rhythm, but, you know, I'm confident everyone on this phone is going to. And Mark and team, thank you guys for including me in this teleconference. Your structure in terms of how you have a portfolio management group, you have advisors, you have client service people, it lends itself to a really, really good client experience, and most groups aren't scaled like that. So it's no surprise as to why you guys are so successful in delighting your clients.
Well, thank you again, Michael. Everybody, I'll repeat that as well. Be safe. Be healthy. Wish you guys well, and look for next Monday's email and next Wednesday's teleconference. Thank you, everybody, for joining. Have a great rest of your day.